Back on the record, Patricia, can you hear us?
She appears to have her phone muted on that end. She can hear us. She is dialed in.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got you now, Patricia. What'd you say?
About being an English teacher.
Do you want somebody to slap his hand with a ruler, Patricia?
Well, no, but I think you have to punctuate a few sentences or two.
Just don't make me diagram.
Okay.
You want her to write on the board something?
Yeah, like, I will be kind to English teacher.
By the way, I'm Joe Green.
You'll get yours.
All right, Patricia, thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and tell us why you're interested in serving on this board and what you bring to the board or commission.
Okay, my name is Patricia Truman. I teach 8th grade language arts at Palmer Junior Middle School. I moved to Alaska in 1978 and have stayed first teaching in Fort Yukon and in Fairbanks and in the Mapton Valley, and I feel like I have a wide experience not only with the regions of Alaska, but a wide experience as far as grade levels are concerned. I've taught every grade K through 12, plus adults. And I feel like not only do I know the teaching profession, but I feel like I have a stellar record.
Any questions for Ms. Truman? Representative Green?
Ain't so.
Representative Bryce?
Thank you. Ms. Truman, this is Representative Bryce. I was just kidding about English teachers, needless to say. I'm assuming you're applying for a teaching position on the PTPC. I just want that on the record.
Yes, it's an appointed position, so I guess I'm not so sure I applied for it, but I was asked to consider it.
Okay, thank you.
Patricia, what do you see as the responsibilities of this commission?
Well, I see that the commission is a double-edged sword, so to speak. On the one hand, the commission protects the teachers who behave ethically and work the job and follow through on their contracts, etc. But on the other hand, it also works to sanction those who don't.
And following up on that, Patricia, so if a teacher is acting professionally and within the policies as defined by a district and they are treated poorly or there's retribution for what they've done when they were correct, would this commission come into play, or would that be a place of remedy for that teacher who is being treated unfairly? Okay, and can, for the purposes of the responsibility of the commission, are principals within your purview of responsibility?
Yes, I think so. I'm not real sure on that. I've only been to one meeting, so I'm still kind of new at this. Anybody who has a certificate, an Alaskan certificate, is purview for our committee, that I know of.
Well, if any of them claim that they're not, most schools are now claiming principals as a part of the classroom or the funding formula. So it'd be interesting if they start claiming they're not when it comes to professional conduct.
Well, as long as they have an Alaska State certificate, I would think that they would fall under the commission.
All right. Any other questions for Patricia? Representative Green.
Thank you. Patricia, what is this in your dossier, paradigm shift, OBE? What's OBE? That's not the OBEGYN thing, is it?
No, it's outcome-based education.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
All right. If there's no further questions, thank you, Patricia, and thank you for being willing to serve.
No problem. Thank you very much.
All right. Now we will, we're going to do some things here a bit out of order for the sake of the convenience of some folks. We have a person here with time constraints who wants to testify on HB 387, so I'm going to open the hearing on HB 387. Pastor?
Thank you very much.
My name is Reverend Robert D. Nicholson. I'm representing the Presbyterian Church USA, which is a 2.3 million member denomination, and I am the pastor at the Chapel by the Lake, a small village church on the edge of Auk Lake. And I'm here to support the bill, to thank you for your consideration of the bill, and to cite three brief examples of why the bill is important. And those are really footnotes to the sponsor statement, which lays the foundation much more graphically than what I'm going to say. Our church nationally is a part of a consortium of about 70 religious denominations that is the whole range from Roman Catholic, Baptist, Lutheran, Christian Scientists, etc., that are trying to see that religious freedom acts like this are embraced by the states across the U.S. because the Supreme Court has backed off from granting the kind of religious freedom that we feel is basic. The two examples I would give you, and this is a concrete example out of the state of Oregon, it happens to be a Presbyterian church, and that is the church, much like Chapel by the Lake, found itself growing. It found itself its native property, and to expand its facilities, it got 10 acres, allowed for parking and a buffer around it, as we have parking and a buffer around us, and the municipality, in issuing the conditional use permit to build a structure, said it's okay to build it, and you've got a nice plan, but you can't have any weddings and you can't have any funerals. And I encourage you to see that that can be one of the consequences of not having this bill that is before you. A second illustration, Presbyterian ministers have the privilege of taking both the Greek language of the New Testament and the Hebrew language so that we are part Jewish as well as Christian. And the Orthodox practice of Judaism is a strict interpretation of the Ten Commandments, as you know, in which you shall not break the Sabbath, and they consider breaking the Sabbath to drive a motor vehicle, so that on the Sabbath we would walk to the closest, like probably might be your house, Bryce's house, and we'd have our families would walk there and have prayers and scripture and then go home. Whereas at Green's house, since he's the target today, the same neighborhood, there would be a Saturday night party with 18 to 25 people there, and an enormous, having just had the alcoholism testimony, an enormous amount of drinking and raucous behavior and noise. And Bryce's house is not licensed as a church, and his house is not licensed as a bar.
You're as confused as Bryce was.
Is it the other way around?
Yeah.
I got backwards.
No, actually, you're pretty right. Green's always been a problem.
But anyway, but the point is that it's okay, you know, for the party and the noise,
but it's
not okay. And the traffic, because all those people are going to drive and drink. Over here, they're going to walk and not drink. Now, what's wrong with that picture?
Let me say,
that's right. So those are my only two illustrations. I do have a kind of a political satire comment about it, and that is that in the People's Republic of China today, the single religious issue that is giving the government more heartburn than anything you're reading are house churches, where people walk to the house and gather and worship. They do have the three self-movement churches, I know that, but it's these house churches where you walk over to Bryce's house and have these surreptitious prayers and reading of scripture and support each other. So thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me in and letting me go.
You're welcome. Any questions for Bob? All right, thanks, Bob. All right, Wes, is Terrio's gang here?
Del Smith to talk to you.
While we're waiting, Mr. Chair. Bob, is it okay if I tell him what you told me, son?
No, never mind. Yeah.
if you want to start, you can start with testimony from DPS, and I'll get my comment.
That's just my quick motion on 387.
Mr. Chairman.
Could you shut Joe down, don't you?
Do you have an amendment to your bill?
I have a proposed CS and can talk about it. We can do it.
While we're waiting for the co-chair of finance, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the appreciate you hearing House Bill 387. I can go through some of the general provisions. I know there are people on testimony who want to talk about it. Maybe it'd be best if we brought the CS before us and I could talk about what the changes it makes.
President Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we adopt committee substitute for 387, 1LS 1461 /G dated 3700 as our working document.
Objection? Thank you. For the record, we have before us CS for House Bill 387, the working draft, the G version.
Let me just briefly describe. It's hard because the initial bill takes a little bit of legal background, but let me just say that the three substantive changes that the committee substitute makes are all attempting to conform to what was the state of the law prior to the Smith decision that then reversed it. And in talking to various people about being accurate about what happened before, the law previous to the Smith decision was that a law of general applicability that placed a substantial burden on religion had to meet was invalid unless the government could show a compelling interest. When I wrote it, I did not accurately state that substantial burden test. It makes you show that there's something more than an incidental effect on the religion, that it's an important one. And that's important to not, I think, have that showing, and that is, I checked it out, an accurate statement of what was before. So that's one change. In addition, it was not generally true that you got damages in this area, money damages. That is, if you pass a general law without intending to affect religion, and it happens to, unbeknownst to you, and they bring that up in a case, and they ask, we want my child to not have to go to the Halloween pageant where there are ghosts and witches and goblins, and there's a general rule you have to or something, you litigate that out, it is generally... was not the practice that you get money from them. You just get an order, let the child go away. And so it released that. In addition, there was a section that talked about the individual rights of others, and we put in the individual rights of a third party to distinguish from who we're talking about. There was just some a legal confusion there. It put into the title, the fourth change really was having the title conform to that substantial burden. But those are the main changes. There were in the bill before A and B, which somewhat confusingly set out you couldn't and then you could under these circumstances. We just pushed them together to say you only can under these circumstances. Largely, they make a difference, but they're simply conforming to the prior practice and somewhat legal or technical. Would you like me to go on with the bill or wait or hear testimony? What's your pleasure, Mr. Chairman?
I'm going to take the testimony from Joe Story. Are you calling in from Oregon, Joe? Are you on?
I am.
Yeah, please give us your testimony, Joe, and then we'll let you get off a long-distance line.
I appreciate that. Yes.
Joe?
Honorable Chairman and committee members, we strongly support, and I say we, I'm representing the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. I'm also pastor of two Seventh-day Adventist churches in Sitka and Juneau. And we strongly support House Bill 387 for several reasons. First, we are mindful of the fact that the Supreme Court's decision in Sherbert versus Verner, 1963, specifically involved a Seventh-day Adventist church member who had been discriminated against at her place of employment on the basis of her firmly held beliefs. We take special interest in the fact that it was in this particular case that the High Court ruled that the state's interest in denying unemployment benefits merely because Mrs. Sherbert would not make herself available for work on Saturday or Sabbath as required by the state unemployment compensation law was insufficiently compelling to warrant an infringement on this most fundamental right, the free exercise of religion. Second, Representatives Cross, Dyson, Coghill, Halcrow, and Sisna's efforts to restore the compelling state interest and least restrictive means test as established in Sherbert versus Verner in 1963 1963 and Wisconsin versus Yoder in 1972 respectively could not come at a better time. Such a provision will effectively restore an individual's right to free exercise of their religious convictions at the state level and prevent the unnecessary discrimination that occurs on a daily basis in the public sector, particularly in the workplace. As Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stated in the Supreme Court's decision in Employment Division of Oregon versus Smith, the court made a critical mistake when they failed to offer convincing evidence to depart from the settled First Amendment jurisprudence. This fundamental departure allows states to make criminal an individual's religiously motivated conduct in a way that burdens an individual's free exercise of religion, puts at a clear disadvantage minority religion and religious practices when leaving accommodation to the political process, and enables government to ignore religious claims altogether if it suits them without offering any compelling justification to support their action. However, as Justice O'Connor reiterated in Smith, the essence of a free exercise claim is relief from a burden imposed by government on religious practice or beliefs, whether the burden is imposed directly through laws that inhibit or compel specific religious practices, or indirectly through laws that, in effect, make abandonment of one's own religion or conformity to the religious beliefs of others the price of an equal place in the civil community. Third, to place on the shoulders of government the burden to prove a compelling interest in order to protect the greater or common good is to place an individual's claim to religious freedom in its rightful place. America's founders, namely Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, believed that the free exercise of religion was the most liberal of all the rights Americans could claim, the one right that placed the greatest trust in the capacity of private choice, and the one least dependent on positive law. In other words, a right that was considered unalienable. Again, to quote Justice O'Connor in Smith, the First Amendment was enacted precisely to protect the rights of those whose religious practices are not shared by the majority. We believe that HB 387 will restore this historical intent at the state level.
Any questions for Mr. Story? Thank you, Joe. All right. Thanks, Joe. Are you going to present Terrio's bill? All right. We're going to suspend the hearing on 387 and take up HB 402. Sorry for the confusion. This is the way we planned it here for quite a while, and we're trying to be thoughtful of many busy people's schedules, including Del Smith, who must have a hot date, right? I see you looking at your watch. We have before us HB 402.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Wilda Rodman. I'm staff to Representative Terrio. I'd like to read my sponsor statement into the record. This legislation is one of many in a long list attempting to deal effectively with minors who have run away from home. Four measures have passed the legislature and become law since 1994. Each of them recognizing and strengthening the rights of parents and legal guardians to make the decisions on placement of the minor. House Bill 402 continues that effort. HB 402 raises the standard by which peace officers determine whether or not to return runaway minors to their parents or legal guardians' residence. Under current law, once a minor has been determined to be a runaway, peace officers are required to return them to their parents or legal guardians' residence unless they have reasonable cause to believe that the minor has experienced physical or sexual abuse in the parents or legal guardians' household. This legislation requires the peace officer to have probable cause to believe such abuse has occurred, a higher standard. The legislature has long grappled with the balance between the rights of parents to raise their children to be productive members of society and the responsibility of protecting those who have been abused physically or sexually. HB 402 is an attempt to make Alaska's statutes reflect the appropriateness of minors abiding by the rules and limits set by their parents. Representative Terrio apologizes that he is delayed in the House Finance Committee, but he wanted to bring this bill up to hear the concerns of the department and committee members.
All right. Any questions? Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand this correctly, as the law currently reads, it would be reasonable for an officer, a police officer, to have a runaway child simply say, I have been abused. And that would be reason enough for that child to not be returned to the family. Is that correct?
I think I'd like to let the department speak to the definition between reasonable and probable. It raises the standard.
Okay.
That's okay.
Sure.
Representative Bryce?
I'll save it for Dale or Annie.
All right. Thank you. Can you stand by?
Sure.
Who's next?
I don't have a date. I just too old for that sort of thing. I'm actually going to Representative Green's house for the party.
Then you're coming over to my house to pray.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving me an opportunity. My name is Del Smith, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I'm here to speak on House Bill number 402. As a law enforcement officer of many years, I am concerned about raising this standard. I certainly worked at the Anchorage Police Department at a time when the child was given the option of where they wanted to go or not go, and we felt that was pretty darn frustrating for the officers at the police department at that point in time. And a couple of years ago, the change of standard here to at least reasonable cause or the child had to be taken home. I believe there's been at least one incident that might prompt this kind of legislation in that, and I think as the incident was related to me, that the officer did not act appropriately. And the child said, I don't want to go home, is my understanding. He said, oh, okay. And I don't necessarily believe that we need to change the law because an officer on a particular department, it's the only one I know of, there may have been others, but I did not appropriately apply it. As to the question of Representative Whitaker, I think that if you pick up a runaway and you got him in a police car and say, well, I'm going to take you home. So, well, I don't want to go home. So, well, why not? So, well, they do bad things to me. So, well, what kind of bad things do they do to you? What has happened? Sort of explain that to me beyond they just do bad things to me. And if they've articulated a fairly reasonable story, I, as a law enforcement officer, or anybody working for me, would I want them to take them back there, at least want to time out while we looked into whether something had really occurred or not. And reflecting upon this yesterday and what I might say over here, I mean, one of the most horrific stories I've ever heard in law enforcement occurred outside is when the cops took the child back to Jeffrey Dahmer's house. Now, I'm not equating any of that here, but I do not want to put an officer in a position of saying, well, sorry, kid, you don't make the mark for probable cause, which is certainly a higher standard than reasonable cause. I think practically speaking, most officers are going to say, if something's been done to me, I don't want it to happen to me anymore, are going to err on the side of saying, okay, well, maybe we need a timeout for somebody to take a look at this. Probable cause is the standard that we use to arrest somebody, to restrict their freedom and take them away. I have to believe that something happened, that it was a crime that had happened to get to probable cause, and I have to believe that Fred Dyson did it for me to do anything about taking Mr. Dyson into custody. I have probable cause to believe a crime is committed, and he did it. I think that's a pretty tough standard to arrive at in a police car somewhere in Fairbanks before you decide what to do with a child. If the child is saying, I don't want to go home, why not? Well, you know, my parents restrict what I do in life. Well, I'm sorry about that. And I'd say, well, we're going there. I would not want, and I can't say that every officer would not do that, but say, well, unless you come up with a better reason than that, I'm going to have to take you back to your parents. I mean, that's human nature, and it may well occur. I would not want that to be occurring. So if it were me, I'd say, well, why don't you want to go home? Well, they won't let me go out on Tuesday nights, and I can't smoke cigarettes, and I can't drink. That does not rise to the level of reasonable abuse kinds of considerations. And I think I can stop there and try to answer any questions that you may have regarding that. I just think it is too high a standard, one that we use for determining whether or not we take somebody's freedom away from them to arrive at whether or not something's really happened to this child or this young person.
Representative Bryce?
What's the legal test for reasonable cause, and what's the legal test for determining probable cause?
Well, I can, through the chair, I can only speak to the practical applications. I think Andy may be better tuned to talk about what the law says, what the standards, legal standards are for those. But reasonable or probable cause to me is that, you know, that something's happened and that there's a person that's pretty sure that somebody's done it. I'm a little difficult, have a difficulty in applying it to a situation where somebody's telling me something that has happened to them or not happened to them. Because generally, if somebody comes up to a police officer and says, you know, this has happened to me, we don't try to set some standard about whether it did or not. We take the report, and if it turns out that it's false, we file a false police report charge against them. But that kind of triage normally would not occur. And in this kind of a situation, the law would ask them to apply some kind of triage at that point, whether you accept a complaint from somebody, in my view. Reasonable cause is what I was trying to respond to Representative Whitaker is, you know, kid said, I want to go home. Why don't you want to go home? Well, I've been made to do things I don't like to do, or they beat me. Well, okay, when and where and how and who, how many times? I mean, try to fill out the story.
I guess the point being is, I mean, I've talked to a lawyer or two, and I'll talk with Annie about it, and we can maybe enter this discussion. There's not a great, it's a real vague issue between the difference between reasonable cause and probable cause. Would you put it that way? I mean, in practical terms.
Well, through the chair, I mean, the term normally I've referred to as reasonable suspicion and probable cause. Reasonable cause is a not sure exactly where that came from. It's obviously in statute since I'm looking at it here. But reasonable suspicion might be an instance where I'm in a neighborhood where it's had a lot of burglaries. It's midnight, and there's some guy slipping and sliding around the neighborhood. Now, I might have reasonable suspicion to believe that he is about to do a burglary or has done one, at least enough to stop him and do a field interrogation and find out who's there. Would not be probable cause to take him into custody unless I'd found a broken door, some blood on it, and a guy two blocks away with blood on it.
Representative Green?
Yeah, I appreciate that analogy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask, Dell, in your experience or those that you work with, if by leaving the standard the way it is, or A, are you still requiring a higher degree of judgment exercising than if it were raised to probable? And the other part of the question would be, by raising it up, would we prevent, now, you got our attention with Jeffrey Dahmer, but I'm thinking more of the types that we're going to have to probably deal with, those between a spanking and a razor strap or a slug in the mouth. Those are the kinds of things that you have to deal with now. Would this take that out of your dilemma or your concern area? Would this help, or would...
Well, to the Chair, if I understand the question, Representative Green, if we left it at reasonable cause...
In one case, if you left it there, you have to make a lot more the officers would have to make a lot more decisions or determines, because, as you said, you might have a suspicion, reasonable suspicion, but you know right away you don't have just a probable cause. So that's, if it were probable cause, then you're not going to... You're going to deal with this kid differently or person differently.
Well, I think if it was a probable cause standard and the law was changed, and you'd probably have to, if you're going to obey the law the way it's written, take the child home, mm-hmm. unless you had evidence to establish probable cause, I mean, seriously beat up. But mm-hmm. even then, you don't know that that's the parent. Mm-hmm. Could have got beat up with whoever he's hanging around with or she's hanging around with. I think as a practical matter, most law enforcement officers are going to err toward doing what they would do now. Say, well, you know, you've given me enough reason to cause me to pause about where you want to go or where we need to take you, so I'm going to take a time out, as it were, and mm-hmm. have somebody else sort this out. I'm not going to stick you back into a situation where you may be abused. And I don't know that I've directly answered your question. I'm not trying to avoid it. It's just that the situation where the guy says, I just don't want to go home, if the cop is applying the law in the right way, said, so what? Sorry, we're going home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go home because things have happened to him, and you need to question further about what's happening to them. To get to the probable cause level, I think takes a lot more time, energy, and investigation, if you will, than we should be requiring a law enforcement officer on the street to arrive at, to which really some basis for these allegations. I mean, certainly our people out there are going to say, I don't want to go home simply and make up stuff. I mean, that's true.
Thank you. Can you stand by for a little bit?
Yes, sir.
All right, Annie?
My name is is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. And I was just talking to Elmer because I recall, I think, being in this room several years ago talking about why, when we were dealing with the children's bill, and I think the standard used to be reasonable suspicion, I believe, and they changed it to reasonable cause to raise that a little bit. But the Department of Law does support and agree with the Department of Public Safety when it voices its concerns about the probable cause standard, because that is the legal standard that we use to arrest somebody. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to take a child home in every case unless you have enough evidence to arrest their parent. I think that would be dangerous, and you want to give the police the chance to apply the reasonable cause standard if the reasons are given by the child that seem to make sense, and take some time to investigate them and figure them out before you take them home to what could be a dangerous situation.
Representative Bryce?
Back to the question I was asking Dale.
A definition.
Because I was sitting in this room when we were having this discussion, and it was, we were sort of making a duck-billed platypus when we were making this cause, because nobody had heard of that standard.
So is your recollection the same as mine when we changed it to? I think it's a very dynamic standard, and I could find case law for you and see how the courts have defined it. It's not defined in our statutes. But when I think of reasonable cause, I think of good reasons to believe that there might be something bad happening to a child. When I think of probable cause, I think of what Dell described as enough reason to convince a judge to get a warrant for his or her arrest, that a crime has been committed and that person committed the crime.
And sort of this, Mr. Chair, if I may, sort of... As I recall, it was, my confusion was when it was explained probable causes, or when a reasonable person suspects that a crime is committed and this person's committed that crime, which came into the question of, well, then what's reasonable cause? A reasonable cause is when a reasonable person suspects that, you know, there's reason that this had happened. So I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit perplexed. It's not clear to me that changing probable to reasonable or reasonable to probable isn't interchangeable. And simply because when we established the reasonable cause standard, nobody knew what it was, and as you were saying, it's been very dynamic.
Well, through the chair, I think when you talk about reasonable cause, you are less talking about who did it than whether something bad happened. That's how I would think of it. If a police officer were interviewing a child, picked up a runaway and said, and police officers do that,
okay,
do this every day. They talk to the child, they evaluate. I mean, if a kid gets in the car and says, I don't want to go home because, you know, and obviously is just wanting to not to go home, then a police officer could evaluate that like they're trained to do. But I think about it in terms of if the child gives reason to believe that something is bad has happened, you don't want to return them to their original environment. I think of probable cause more is it is more likely than not that something bad has happened and a particular person did it. I don't know if that's helpful to you or not, and I'd be happy to get you case law on it. But it is, you know, it's something that we use all the time, but we don't have I don't have a good, Webster's type definition for you, but I will get the best I can in terms of court decisions.
Are you getting what you want?
Yes.
Okay. We are not going to do anything with this bill. The sponsor wanted to get this kind of input and so on. Dell, when a police officer picks up somebody, hears a sad song with or without accusations, and the officer decides, I don't want to take this kid home based on what I've heard, where do they take him? Where does he do next? What's next step for the cop that's got a sniveling kid in his front seat?
Either some prior arrangements where there's not a DFYS person on duty, or call DFYS and say, I've got this person. Where do you want me to take them? Where do we take them tonight?
Okay.
What we're trying to avoid, certainly in the past, was keeping them in the police car at the police station. We need to get rid of them loose and get the cop free again. But normally we would call and say, this is the deal. We've got to put them somewhere.
Right, and then Elmer, what happens then? Does DFYS do some kind of an evaluation process? Do an intake kind of a thing? Welcome to the hot seat, Janet.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Janet Stewart. I'm with the Division of Family and Youth Services. And I can tell you in general that the division supports the department's interpretation of this. We are not comfortable with adding a second set of standards. We already use reasonable cause as a standard for mandatory reporters, and police are mandatory reporters. This is something that they're familiar with in the civil context. To then throw in a standard which is most traditionally used in criminal law and which is so infrequently used in civil law that you've got all of us lawyers sort of bumbling. We think is going to confuse the issue for police officers and may well subsequently confuse the issue for DFYS when they get an officer who has had to articulate something based on a criminal law standard. It's not going to be as clear to the social workers if the police officer has made an assessment based on a criminal standard and now they're coming to us with a child that has to be placed under civil standards. We think that that's going to be apples and oranges and will cause confusion for the police as well as for our social workers.
Okay. That's very good information. Didn't answer my question.
And can you, I need to
what know. Happens when the police officer calls DFYS, delivers the kid to some emergency foster home or group home, then what happens? What does DFYS
for do? Our purposes, that becomes a report of harm under the report of harm standards, and we will do an intake investigation and assess at that point, as we would assess whether it was a police officer bringing the child in any other way,
then you
what
kick,
to do.
Then you kick in the hearing before a magistrate within 48 hours
yes.
and all of that stuff with hopefully right. its incumbent protections.
Right.
Right. Representative Bryce, you had a question?
Actually, maybe a couple, Mr. Chair. Quickly, are the runaway statutes, they're under the civil laws, they're not under the criminal laws.
That's right.
Okay.
This is all in the childhood of need, through the chair, this is all through the childhood need of aid statutes. These are not criminal statutes.
Representative Coggin?
Yeah.
At the 48-hour hearing then, isn't it also true that that standard is probable cause if they're going to continue on and determining if that's a child in need of assistance.
That's a second proceeding, and that is an issue that relates directly to the child's placement. And you're right, yes.
That's their determination, and so that you're going to hear that word again
right.
at that particular
right.
point. But at the time that you decide that this is not going to go into that arena, what is your criteria for deciding that? Is it, once again, do we come back to reasonable
right.
cause?
The reasonable cause is the entry-level criteria that in the mandatory reporters section and for the runaway section, that first set of standards is a reasonable cause at present.
At that point, then, is that when you contact the parent of the individual?
That the parent of the individual would be contacted at that point, depending on a whole panoply of circumstances.
But that would be on your determination of what reasonable
right.
cause is and how you're going to deal with it.
Right.
That's the dynamic part of it.
That's correct.
Representative Bryce, you have another question?
I'll go after Joe.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This
Tom
is a...
Green. Big pardon, Tom Green.
Do you have any feel for how many children have been finally adjudicated as, yes, having had problems at home that would not have been brought in if the bar had been raised as proposed here? Are you familiar? Did I make that question?
And through
okay.
the chair, I understand your question. I have absolutely no feeling for that. I'm not even sure how we'd go about getting statistics on that. We might need to correlate it through the Department of Law, trying to assess how many of those were children refusing to accept care. I don't have a good answer for
okay.
that.
Representative Bryce.
Here's where I'm getting confused. Talking to my social worker buddies.
Hello, talk.
Here's over Green's having a pint beer.
Making me blush, sure. I don't hear from them about investigations taking place on runaways. Mostly, the scenario I hear about mostly are from parents or children who in Fairbanks would run away, get picked up by the cops, get taken to Family Focus, spend the night at Family Focus, and then go home. I don't think I've ever heard of anything going to the magistrate hearing. Do all runaway pickups go to the 48-hour hearing?
No, they don't. Through the chair, no, they don't. You know, we have an individual assessment that will have to be made, and you may not hear of some of those cases because we don't take them to 48-hour hearing under the rubric of being a runaway. We will take them to a 48-hour hearing because the information that we obtained from the runaway is that this is a child who has been physically or sexually abused in the home.
Thank you.
We will move to the stronger course of action rather than relying on a course of action which depends on a child's ability to protect himself or herself.
Okay.
Representative Whitaker.
Along that same line, if I might, just so I understand the standards at the various steps as we work our way along. The police officer currently has a reasonable standard.
Yes.
Right. Okay, and the DFYS social worker, as part of the individual assessment, has a reasonable standard.
The reasonable cause standard.
Reasonable cause standard, yes.
Correct.
Okay, and if as a result of that reasonable standard it's determined that custody is in the child's best interest, it then goes to the 48-hour hearing. The judge then has a probable cause standard?
Correct.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? All right. We are going to suspend the hearing then on HB 402, and we will await your instructions when and if you want to take this up again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We will reconvene our hearing on HB 387. Three more Teacher Practices Commission folks tonight? Call in.
Tonight?
Yes. And we'll when and they do call in.
It's two of one.
I'm sorry. Two more call in. And then we'll take them when they do, out of consideration for them, if that's permissible to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Also, Mr. Croft, Reverend Croft, Representative Croft, we have received some communication, voluminous communication from the ACLU, our mutual friends, and having that copied to be distributed.
And I know we have some testimonies, and I know that it's been a busy day for the committee. Let me, as briefly as possible, I apologize for how heavy on the legal analysis this whole thing is, but it at its fundamental heart is protection of religious liberty. It brings in a lot of legal history and ideas that I want to just briefly go over to establish where we are today. It's been a long-standing tradition in this history, of course, of a respect for religious freedom. That general respect was specifically codified in constitutional interpretations in the late 60s and early 70s that required that a law of general applicability, a law that wasn't targeted at religion, and by the way, a law that is targeted at religion, that you can show its intent was to stop people exercising their religion, has always been invalid. You could never do that. But the more important question, because that's very rare, happens as we would think and hope very infrequently, the more important question is when you just pass a general law, not directed at religion, but that it, in its application, affects a religious practice, puts a substantial burden in the phraseology of the court. What should be the decision? There are really two poles there. You might argue, and Justice Scalia would argue and did eventually prevail, that general law, you're not targeting religion, you don't have to make any exceptions at all. So I guess under his interpretation, if in prohibition there had not been an exception for the use of sacramental wine on Sundays for religious practice, if it had just said alcohol is prohibited in this country without exception, and you couldn't show it was targeted at religion, prohibition had many other purposes, it wasn't to do that, there would be no exception, and police could haul away a priest on Sunday who served wine. Now that seems both maybe ridiculous, but at least contrary to our tradition that could happen. I put it to you that it could without the protection that an exception will be made unless the state can show a compelling interest. So. United States Supreme Court precedent starting in the 60s and 70s, they said, even a law that wasn't intended to affect religion, if that's the effect of it, placing a substantial burden, we're going to say that the person is excused from compliance with that law unless the government can show a compelling state interest and that this is the least restrictive way to do it. In other words, you reverse the burden. You say, once you have shown that this affects your religious, puts a substantial burden on your religious practice, you're exempt unless the government now has the burden of proof to show that you that the law should be upheld and applied to you because it's a compelling state interest. In other words, an important reason, and that there's no other way really to do it. As I said, that was the law from the early 70s. I mentioned in the sponsor statement the Yoder case, which was in some ways the defining law. That all changed in 1990 with the United States Supreme Court decision of Smith v. Employment Division, which Pastor Story referred to. And in it, Justice Scalia, writing for a divided court, 5-4, a very close decision, said, and I'm quoting now Justice O'Connor's dissent, the court today interprets the free exercise clause to permit the government to prohibit without justification conduct mandated by an individual's religious beliefs so long as that prohibition is generally applicable. Now, that raised a firestorm of protest from all points of the political spectrum, and the federal government attempted to fix it. A bipartisan coalition in Congress passed what was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It attempted to tell, despite the federal Supreme Court's retreat, every state and municipal government, as well as the federal government, that they had to conform to this compelling interest test. They used, and it was signed by President Clinton, so a bipartisan support. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court struck that down as well, on different grounds, which we can get into if you want to get your amateur lawyer badge for your Boy Scouts pledge or what. But on basically Congress being and the federal government being a government of limited authority, has to be authorized somewhere in the Constitution. We have general power. They have only the specific powers delegated in the Constitution. And essentially the Supreme Court said in the City of Bourne case, where do you find the justification to, where is the constitutional authority to tell every state and municipal government that they have to conform to this? Is it the Commerce Clause? Doesn't look very commercial. Is it, under what enumerated power do you find this authority? And they held none, which left it up to the state. Now, what is the condition in Alaska, in the state with which we live? Realize that there are, of course, two different freedom of religion clauses, one in the federal constitution and one in the state constitution. They are virtually identical, patterned off each other. But our determination of what our Alaska constitutional provision means, even if identical to the feds, is our own to decide. We don't, as they change, we don't necessarily change. We interpret the words, even though similar, on our own. And as far as we can tell right now, our Supreme Court has not shown an indication that they're retreating along with the feds. They have stuck, we think, to the compelling interest standard. However, like the federal government, like the federal Supreme Court, that could change either with a change in the court or a change in judicial interpretation. The purpose of this bill is to establish that compelling state interest standard in statutory form in case there is a retreat. I do not think, if properly drafted, and I hope it is properly drafted, that it will amount to a substantial change in the current practice under Alaska law, because it's the current Alaska Supreme Court interpretation. Don't expect it'll be a big difference. It is, if you will, buttressing the foundation. So in case there is such a change, we will have already on the books statutes protecting this. As I said, the Alaska Supreme Court has stayed with the compelling state interest since the retreat in Smith. We have applied it before under our Constitution to allow exemptions from neutral laws, and I cite one of those there. So I guess with that, Mr. Chairman, we can hear some of the testimony. I saw your testimony sheet. We have had before, in the previous hearing, testimony from very genuine, very interested people who are very worried about any statute that purports to talk about religion. They have, I think, a healthy distrust of government involvement in religion, and simply, I think, the title, an act requiring governmental entities, including municipalities and school districts, to meet certain requirements before placing a substantial burden on a person's free exercise, I think just scares them. They don't want any. They don't want all. I emphasize to them, as I did in the Community and Regional Affairs Committee, that this is an increase in protection. It is either doing what we do now, or should the Alaska Supreme Court retreat as the feds did, it is an increase in it. It is not something that that is intended to or will have the effect of decreasing. It's quite the opposite, religious protection. And so I recognize their concern. I know where it comes from, but I just reiterate to them, and I don't know the content of their testimony now, that it is a protection rather than a diminution of religious freedom rights.
Thank you. I'm going to suspend a hearing on HB 387 for a few minutes here. Christine Miller has called in. She's from North Pole. I believe she's, and is one of our candidates for the Professional Teachers Practicing Commission. Can you hear us, Christine?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, thank you for being willing to serve, Christine. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. We have your resume before us, and why you would like to serve on the commission and what you believe you bring to the commission.
My name is Christine Miller Dart. I was born and raised in Alaska and have lived here all my life except to go outside to go to college. Both my undergrad program in Bellingham, Washington, and my grad program in Seattle, Washington. I've been teaching or acting as a speech therapist for the Fairbanks School District for 20, this is my 21st year as a speech therapist in the school district. This will be my second term on PTPC. I was first appointed in the year 96-97. I spent 3 years on the commission and beginning my fourth. Right now I'm acting as secretary for the commission. I think it's an invaluable commission and would like to continue serving on it. I feel very responsible for the profession and for monitoring the profession to see that we have good quality teachers who follow a very strong code of professional ethics.
Are there any questions for Christine?
Quickly.
Representative Bryce.
Christine, sounds a little bit silly. You're married to John Dart, right?
Yes, I am.
Tell him hello for me. This is Tom Bryce.
I will, Tom. Hmm.
Any other questions for Christine? Chairman Dyson, maybe you can help me a little bit and tell me some of the issues that have come before the commission while you've been seated.
Of a superintendent misuse of
her. I bet you can write a doctoral thesis when you get done, Christine.
It's been an education, to say the least, yes.
Teacher tells all. Have you dealt with any cases of teachers being inappropriately disciplined when the teacher was doing the right thing, but the district or the school board disciplined them or showed prejudice or retribution?
Us on the commission with the case, and most of, I can't think of a case where in the last couple of years, where her investigation hasn't determined that a district handled things within the proper channel, and the complaint is not heard by the commission, and then it's challenged by the person filing the complaint, and we have ruled with the commission, with the executive director, after the appeal hearing that we conduct.
All right, one last question, Christine. Does your commission's purview extend to all credentialed educators?
All credentialed educators, but there are educators who are not credentialed, such as in the university system.
Right. Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions for Christine? Christine, sorry I forgot the missed the last part of your name. Thank you for being willing to serve and the service you've had. All right, with that, we'll go back to HB 387.
I closed mine, Mr. Chairman. If you're ready for testimony, we could do that.
All right, I'm going to take in Anchorage, Mr. Richard Block. Can you hear us, Richard?
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify. For the record, my name is Richard Block. I am the Committee on Publication, Christian Science Committee on Publication for the State of Alaska. And just briefly, what that means is that I have been asked by the Christian Science churches in the state to keep an eye on how the practice of Christian Science and our church and our activities are viewed by the public, and that would include overviewing legislative activity that would affect the practice of Christian Science by those who follow our beliefs. This bill, which really doesn't have a trick name, but I guess I'll call it the Religious Freedom Protection Act or Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is more of the name attached to its federal counterpart, is a bill that we vigorously support. However, I didn't testify. I attended the hearing here the other day before Community and Regional Affairs and did not testify, but I was in communication with the staff of Representative Croft, and they asked that I would publicly voice our support for the bill, and so I'm here today to do that. I think it would be inappropriate for me to try to better the discussion of the constitutional issues involved that Representative Croft gave both last week before Community and Regional Affairs and what he's done briefly this afternoon, because he obviously has a good grasp of the issue and a clear understanding of the role that this legislation would play in the state were it to be adopted, and I believe he understands the importance to the large number of faith communities in the state that would be protected by it and all of their followers. So let me just simply state that I and our churches vigorously support this bill and urge its adoption. Unfortunately, I'm reading the original version of it. I don't have what you're referring to, I guess, is the Gulf version. I don't have that yet. They've been trying to fax it up here. But listening to Representative Cross' discussion of what the changes are, we would continue our support for the proposed committee substitute. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and stand available for questions.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Brock. Any questions? All right. If not, I'm going to go to Tok. And for the folks that are there in Tok, I would like to take testimony from the people who did not get a chance to testify in front of Community and Regional Affairs, and I would encourage you that if your testimony is by and large, similar to the person that's testified ahead of you, that you can give us your name and say ditto or whatever, and I don't in any way want to restrict your input, but also we're really pressed with time with some important business this afternoon, and this bill will get two more hearings, and I suspect particularly in judiciary, it'll be a long and very detailed hearing, and I would encourage you to do that, and if you'll contact my office, or I suspect Representative Croft, he'll also get you a copy of some other testimony that's come in, including stuff from the ACLU, that may give you a more informed opinion if you want to testify at later meetings. So, to the folks there in Tok, can we hear from anybody that didn't testify last time? It certainly is, and we would also enjoy you faxing or emailing it down to us, but I would like to hear from the individuals who didn't testify last time first, if that's okay. Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Next, in Tok, please. Thank you, Jamie. The sponsor of the bill is busy taking notes here and nodding as you're speaking. Who's next?
I believe I'm next. I did testify last week. Is everyone else here testified? Everyone else here has testified.
All right, go ahead. Identify yourself, please.
Yes, my name is Ronald Axelaris. And like the previous testifiers, I support the intention of the bill. I support the protection of religious freedoms. And I want to help you to make sure that it will work. I believe that that you have done good work to get it this far, but I believe that it's still the wording of the bill is still very vague and therefore open to misinterpretation by the courts. So to rectify this and clearly safeguard our religious freedoms, I believe that two statements should be included in the bill, and I'd like to present those statements now. The first statement comes from the Supreme Court Smith case, the majority opinion which we've been discussing. It's a statement that the respondents made that the court disagrees with, but if you follow the stated intention of House Bill 387, I believe it is one you will agree with, as I do. The statement is, quote, prohibiting the free exercise of religion includes requiring any individual to observe a generally applicable law that requires, parentheses, or forbid, end parentheses, the performance of an act that his religious belief forbids, parentheses, or requires, end parentheses, end quote. I can read this again later if you'd like, or refer to it in the Smith case.
Was that from the dissent or the majority?
That was from the majority. And it's the way I have it, I don't know if this was, if we have the same copies, but it is on, I believe, page 6 of my copy.
If you could, can you, Lyle, that'd be really helpful if you'd fax that down to us.
Okay, yes, reading it, it's hard to read it out loud and listen to it to its meaning, but essentially the statement is a definition of what Article 1, Section 4 of the Alaska Constitution means by, and the U.S. Constitution, by saying that the free exercise of religion should not be prohibited by any law. I believe that the inclusion of this statement into House Bill 387 will help tremendously in ensuring the correct interpretation of this bill and our constitutional right to freely exercise our religion. Now, the second statement that I think needs to be included into House Bill 387 in order to safeguard the intention of the bill and truly protect our religious freedom is a definition of compelling governmental interests and a definition of religious practices. The statement is, and this is something I've written, quote, compelling governmental interest is when the government finds that the conduct of an individual is harmful to another individual or the community at large. Conduct that falls under the definition of religious practice, as is stated below, is automatically exempt from restriction even under a compelling governmental interest test. Now, here's the definition of religious practice. Religious practice, parentheses, as it is applied according to the Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, and parentheses, include but are not limited to 1. Personal expression and worship in both life and death. 2. The choice of medicine and healing methods or the refusal thereof. 3. The choice of education style and content for adults and children. 4. The choice of dietary practices, including the foods eaten or not eaten, and the foods used for spiritual practices, including ceremonies revolving around one's death, and the means of harvesting such food. And finally, 5. The method of raising and caring for the children under the form of worship. And that's end quote. Excuse me.
All right. Thank you, Lyle.
You're welcome. Do you have any questions?
Not at this time. All right, Tabitha Parker.
Hi, my name is Tabitha Parker, and I'm representing myself. I do support the protection of our religious freedoms and the intention of this bill. However, I feel that the vagueness of certain areas of this bill are problematic and need clarification. Firstly, I would like to know how the Alaska Constitution defines compelling governmental issues. It was said at the Community and Regional Affairs Committee public hearing last week that compelling governmental interest is the highest standard. If this is true, then why has this not been defined clearly in the bill itself? Furthermore, my understanding of the compelling governmental interest test is that it is more of an interpretation or judgment made by a judge or a group of judges than a clearly defined objective form of evaluation. How can one's religious rights be protected when, as in the 1990 Employment Division v. Smith case, the interpretation of the law was decided on by a subjective judicial system, which may have absolutely no understanding of the underlying beliefs of the religion they judged? This is problematic and has been throughout history. How do we know that compelling governmental interests won't be used against religious practices? If compelling governmental interest is determined by the court, then what stops the judge from declaring that it is a compelling governmental interest, for example, to restrict the use of alcohol, even in religious uses, or to mandate vaccinations, even if vaccines fundamentally offend one's religious beliefs? It seems that compelling governmental interest can override religious freedoms at the whim of a court's decision. And I would like the vagueness of this bill to be more clearly defined to ensure our freedom of religion, that our freedom of religion is protected. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Michael Riley, do you have something in addition to say to the testimony we've gotten?
Yes, I do. Thank you. My name is Michael Riley. I'm representing myself. I'd like to state my support of the bill and its intentions. I have two questions I'd like to have addressed. First is, if an Alaskan case of religious freedom restricting religious freedom restriction goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, would this bill, if it becomes law, prevent the U.S. Supreme Court from ruling against the religious practitioner? In other words, does this bill automatically exempt religious practices
Thank you, Mr. Riley. I suspect maybe you and the sponsor can talk on the phone and get some of your questions answered. Amy Jo Rist?
Hello, thank you. My name is Amy Jo Rist, and I am representing myself. And I would like to say that I do support the protection of our religious freedoms and the intention of this bill, as has been stated in the previous testimonies. And I also agree with the previous testimonies that further clarity is needed regarding the compelling governmental interest. I also have one question regarding Council 387 pertains to school boards, school districts, municipalities, and state agencies, prohibiting these bodies from restricting the free exercise of religion unless there is a compelling governmental interest to do so. But it doesn't make mention of state legislator or corporations, and I know at the last hearing there were many examples of corporate policies that restricted workers' religious practices. And I'm wondering why these examples are brought up if corporations are not covered in this bill, and if the state legislature can make laws that restrict religious practices without a compelling governmental interest, because the legislature is also not incorporated into this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Anyone else here in the room? I have no one else on the telenet, I believe. Is anybody else here in the room that wants to testify? What's the pleasure of the committee?
Excuse me, there were several questions that asked from this office that haven't gotten answered. I know there's not much time, but I'm interested as well as Ms. Risk's question, if this bill would apply to the state legislature and to corporations.
Yeah, Lyle?
Yes.
A part of our format here is that you know, we're getting input from the public and so on, and there'll be a, if you'll call the sponsor, I think that you'll get some answers to some of your questions and get some feedback for you. Unfortunately, that's not something that we can take up at this time.
But I see. Thank you.
You betcha. And we're looking forward to getting your testimony in writing. What's the risk of the pleasure of the committee? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move committee substitute for House Bill 387, NAB committee, with individual recommendation attached fiscal note.
Objection? Committee substitute, yeah. Do you have something you want to say?
I didn't, but if I can I call to link with them as long as they're all there and answer some of those questions? Just run up to my office and talk to them. Is there any way to do that?
I don't see why not. I'll give you the number right now.
Okay, if you guys would just stay there and talk for just a second, I'll run back to my office and call in and answer some of the goes. The committee has to go, but they were very good questions, and I'd like to address them.
Thank you.
Is there objection to moving this bill? For those of you who don't have one handy, here's some.
Intimidation there.
You don't need to sign them, only if you ever want to get a bill heard here. All right. HB 387 is moved with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Thank you all.
We will. Dave, has anybody called in yet? Any more?
No, sir. We're waiting for the last person, right?
All right, we'll take up Mr. Lawrence Lee Oldacre of Auk Bay. Please join us, Lawrence. We have a very impressive resume from you. You must be a lot older than you look.
Thank you, sir. You got the short version, the brief one. I am Lawrence Lee Oldacre, and I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Alaska Southeast, and I live just beyond Auk Bay. And I have been invited to be a nominee for the higher ed position on the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, the one of nine seats specifically designated to a university, higher ed.
Right.
Okay.
And this would be your first time serving?
Yes, sir.
Why do you want to serve, Lawrence? You bored?
Retirement's good.
Not that good.
Not that good. I've always had a deep sense of fairness and equity about it. I was a teacher for 3 years, interviewed for a superintendency and got it. And so I was pushed out as a boy superintendent into the what was very interesting and challenging racial integration, desegregation days. With the passage of years, I find that they were very exciting, and I can reflect on them more pleasantly. But at the time, I was dealing with issues related to equity, school admission, and school policies. I served as a superintendent for 9 years, and then was invited into higher education, where I went to Valdosta State College to help them create and did a leadership program. Then I was recruited to come to the University of Alaska here and do the same. And so during this time, I picked up an academic interest in law and ethics, and I've taught the course for perhaps 30 years, and I have conducted research, made presentations and publications on that very subject.
Any questions? Representative Bryce.
Quick clarification. You said you were at Valdosta State College?
Yes, sir.
When was that?
60-65.
I don't know if I can support anybody who worked at Valdosta State College now.
I'll have to count in votes. You sound like you were from the South.
And no, you, I'm just kidding, Mr.
Yes,
Oldacre.
And I wish
went there.
He did. Well, wonderful.
How did he turn out?
He just dropped out.
I'd like to speak about academic rigors.
Are there any other questions for Lawrence? Thank you, sir, for your past service and your willingness to serve in this capacity.
Thank you very much, Representative Tyson.
We have just had dialed in from Palmer, Linda Connolly. Are you there, Linda?
Yes, hello. Mr. Tyson?
Yes.
Hello.
And an entire committee of people at Rapt Attention. We have your resume before us as well.
Oh, great.
So tell us about yourself and why you're willing to do this or interested in doing it.
Well, I have been an educator for over 25 years, both as a teacher and currently as an administrator for the last 12 or 13 years. This is a reappointment for me to the PTPC, and I'm currently the chair of the PTPC. I guess I just find it fascinating, especially since I've been in administration, I've been interested in obviously the profession and upholding professionalism and overall ethics of all educators. I've served on the State Principals Association for approximately 9 to 10 years and have become more involved in state activities, such as the Licensure Task Force Committee and setting standards for principals, and have become very interested in just serving the profession. So this would be my second term for PTPC.
Any questions for Linda?
I might add that I've been a principal of both a small school where I was a principal and teacher, as well as the principal of my school that was over 600 students that is now a K-5 and down to about 350 in Eagle River, Fire Lake Elementary School in Eagle River.
I bet that was a delightful place to teach, right?
Oh, it is. Both of them have been, both in Mansua and in the Anchorage School District. There's a quite a variety in our career between very small schools of Sutton Elementary and the Mansua School District that was about 80 students going into Anchorage and having a much higher number of students.
Well, it doesn't get any better than Mansua and Eagle River.
No, I don't think so either.
Representative Green has a question.
Yeah, were you the lady I saw demonstrating at University of Berkeley back in the 60s?
You're looking at that resume, aren't you? No, I don't think I've ever been on the cover of Dove newspapers or anything.
That was a question. It is a late in the day.
We look for sixth sense of humor.
Y'all getting hungry, huh?
Yeah, I was in Berkeley in 68. Were you there for the People's Park?
Yes, actually, I was doing summer school during 68, winter of 68 and summer school. It was quite a dramatic time in education.
Yeah, I was there for that one in the Third World Liberation Front strike.
Who was there?
No.
It's Jim Whittaker.
Well, I was just learning to walk. So.
Yeah, it's Chairman Dyson. I got my picture in Life magazine, but you can't see me for the tear gas.
Oh, my goodness. You know, you'll have to come visit me. That's cool, and we'll talk more about this.
Yeah, I actually live in and represent Eagle River, so it's not far.
That's why I was saying you'll have to come visit me.
Yeah, that'd be fun to swap lies about where were you on day which. All right, thank you.
Okay.
And thank you for your willingness to serve and the service you've been.
Thank you, it's an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe there's no further business before us. It's been a very productive afternoon. Sorry for the schedule switches, but I think it worked well for the folks, and I appreciate you all. We are adjourned.